I'm Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe and ESPN.
I'm Mitch Albom of the Detroit Free Press.
I'm Mike Lubick of the New York Daily News and MLB.com. And welcome to the Monday edition of the Sports Reporters podcast. We will be talking today about the NBA. We'll talk a little baseball at the end of the podcast. But we'll start today with golf. And I will just make a couple of opening comments about the United States Open, which I attended this past weekend and found the whining about the golf course and the USGA hilarious. I might have played this particular golf course more than any golfer in the field in my life. So I know this course. I love this course. I believe it's the greatest championship test we have in this country and a perfect setting for our national championship. Did they screw up with a couple of pin placements on Saturday? They did. Did the wind blow harder than they thought it was going to as the day went on? Yes, because early in the day when I was walking around, I'd say, wow, it feels like about half of what it was on Thursday. Having said all that, we produced an amazingly worthy champion yesterday in Brooks Koepka, who repeated for the first time since my pal Curtis Strange did it nearly three decades ago, and was the last guy to win back-to-back Open Championships. We got a 63 from Tommy Fleetwood. I still cannot believe he missed the putt he had on the last hole for 62, which would have broken Johnny Miller's record and broken that huge log jam we have in this country on 63. And Dustin Johnson, who is freakishly good at golf, never did recover from the 77 he shot on Saturday, and he putted the way he did when he putted himself out of an Open against Jordan Spieth at Chambers Bay. But this idea that the golf course was unfair. Guys, I'm sorry. I didn't realize there was a rule passed that they should be able to hit 400-yard drives whenever they want to, never be penalized for missing a fairway. And, oh, by the way, if they want to hit a 5-iron right to the flag, the ball needs to stop
well,
right
Mike,
there.
Well, Mike, I know you're very proprietary towards Shinnecock, and I have a feel for it because, you know, you and I walked together in 04. I know. I remember.
Sure.
And all that. I just think that there's a little bit of legitimacy to the complaints and not anticipating.
No, there is a little bit, Bobby. I
with
wrote
the pin
this
placements
Sunday,
on Saturday.
There is a little
pin
bit.
Placements are what got people. You know, they all know they can't govern the wind, okay? And as you were speaking, I was thinking what this really is, what we really had here on Saturday was a British Open. We had an Open, the Open, in which very often the case is it depends so dramatically on when you go out. And whether you go out in the morning or whether you go out in the afternoon and what's happening in that particular day, that's part of the deal, which they all seem to accept when they go over there, but are less willing to accept in a circumstance here.
I don't understand. You know, first of all, I don't play Shinnecock Hills and I don't play golf to the level that you do, Mike. But I certainly watch plenty of it. I certainly am a fan of it, and I certainly have covered it as a sports writer. And I don't understand why there's this entitlement amongst these golfers to complain about they lost the course. As far as I saw, and this is the way I think I speak for the average sports fan, they lined up all the golfers, they all had to play the same course, and somebody won it. So what's the complaint? I mean, when you play football in the rain or the mud or somebody didn't take care of it, do you say, well, what are they thinking possibly? Both teams had to do the same thing. It's the same thing with golf. So, okay, yeah, pin placement, they're getting a little cute and they're trying to make it too hard. But it was the same for everybody, wasn't it? And it wasn't like they gave people unfair advantages.
And Mitch, early in the day, before the wind picked up, it produced two 66s on Saturday, which put Daniel Berger and Tony Finau into the last group. It was one of the most stunning things I've ever seen at a major championship. They started 11 shots behind and ended up in the last group on Sunday. Listen, Mike Davis, who's a good guy, and I've had my fun with the course setter-uppers in the past. Bobby knows this, okay? He admitted, and when they said they screwed up on a couple of pin placements, Mitch, they're talking about a few yards, okay? 15 was bad on Saturday. 18 was in a very tough spot on Saturday. Yeah, once again, television doesn't give you any sense of how pitched some of those greens are until you see the guys start putting them. But a lot of this happened And I love Phil Mickelson, and he has been the Arnold Palmer, Mitch and Bob of our generation. He acted like an idiot on Saturday, running and hitting that ball like he was a polo player, okay? And what he did would have been a very successful strike in polo, but not good in golf. And whatever explanation that he gave about, oh, he just wanted to take the two-stroke penalty, no, he didn't. No, he did not. He was just tired and frustrated, and he was having a bad day. And in that moment, and by the way, I wasn't one of those guys who acted like he'd kicked a hole in a church window, as Raymond Chandler would say. It wasn't like he had screwed up a church, but he deserved all of the criticism he got after that round.
And you know what the funny thing is, Mike, that given his stature with the average fan and his almost universal popularity amongst Vox Populi, he could have actually endeared himself even further by going, the oh, gee, shucks, I lost myself. I can't believe I did that. What a stupid am I. Yeah. Bah, 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 bah. As he did, when he hit the ball over the house and back in the other hole, Mamaroneck. And it would have been, he would have even enhanced his stature with people even more instead of lying about it.
It's what his wife said, Bob and Mitch. It's what Amy said to the Daily News yesterday, that it wasn't a very good moment for my husband, which went against the heroic spin he tried to put on it on Saturday.
I agree with her. At her comments. She was right. And Bob, you're right. He's the kind of guy who, if he just said, man, that's how frustrated I was. You know, what a boneheaded move
right,
I pulled
Mitch.
Off.
Yep.
It would have been fine. And I don't think anybody would have had a problem with it. And fine. If they're frustrated, fine. But I don't get this sense of, since when was golf supposed to be, in particular the U.S. Open, which has its history, supposed to lay itself out so that you can score 14 under par every single round? They ended up finishing right around the par
one over
mark.
Par wins.
Terrible?
Mitch, one over par one, and it's because he knew he didn't need to make a par on 18. I believe if Koepka needed a par on 18, he would have made a par on 18. Anybody who plays the course knows you're safe left, right? You're in big trouble. So he was really playing for five on that hole. And Mitch, you're right. I was hoping he would end up at level par, because what do you always hear? Last year was an aberration at Erin Hills when Brooks won with a 16 under. What do you always hear at the start? Par is a good score at the U.S. Open. And I was hoping, Mitch, you're 100% right. I was hoping that par was going to win.
And came pretty damn close. So, okay, Jordan Spieth, Rory McIlroy, John Rahm, Jason Day, Tiger Woods, who just continues to astonish me with his own spin on his own game. I remember after he shot whatever he shot on the first day, which was ridiculous. On the first hole, he was basically out of it. He comes back. He says, I'm hitting the ball well. I'm doing good. All I got to do is shoot around.
Have you seen me swing lately?
Yeah. All I got to do is hit around in the 60s tomorrow, and I'm right back in it. Well, except that didn't happen, and he's gone and missed the cut. And the self-delusion about Tiger Woods. Even somebody wrote on, I don't know if it was ESPN or whatever, hey, don't let one bad U.S. Open fool you. He's going to win another major, maybe this year. Okay, I don't know who you're watching, but it ought to come with a ghost shadow on it, because you're not watching the same Tiger Woods as me. But meanwhile, you do have people like Brooks Koepka. You do have people like Dustin Johnson, although I think we have to start at Patrick Reed, who
was great Finau. Yesterday.
Patrick Reed was great, and I mean, I know people don't particularly care for his personality, but his golf is pretty exceptional right now. I do think the questions are going to start circling around Dustin Johnson. He's got one major in his career. He's in his mid-30s. He's one of these great,
and Mitch,
great
he's not
talent.
A great putter. Mitch, you saw it yesterday. Whether, you know, again, I know you don't play a lot of golf, but you saw it yesterday.
Yeah.
Koepka, you were surprised when he didn't make a 5 or 6 or 10 footer. Dustin, you were surprised when he made a 3 footer coming down the stretch.
Yeah, and with the lead that he had after 36 holes, remember, this isn't the first time or the second time or even the third time in majors that he's been close and he's kind of crapped out,
right.
Especially at U.S. Opens. I know he's won one in his career, but 2010, 2011, 2015, he had chances and he missed it. He missed one at the PGA. So he's dangerously on the precipice of people starting to think that he's a guy who can't close. He's a Greg Norman without as many wins as Greg Norman, and that's going to... That's going to hurt him. But, I mean, these are all good golfers we're talking about here. So the fact that Spieth and Woods and McIlroy, whatever, crapped out on this day doesn't give them the right to say, well, it only happened because they screwed up the golf course. Because some other pretty good golfers managed to be in the game and managed to finish high and win it.
Maybe talk for a minute about one of those golfers, Tommy Fleetwood, and because this is not the first thing he's done of significance this year. And by the way, Mike, my feeling on missing the putt on 18 is the golf god said, okay, look, we've let you go far enough with these other putts you're making, but you're not getting this. And really, I wasn't shocked that he missed it. It just was law of averages almost caught up. But the fact is, this guy is making his mark in the year 2018. And I'm just thinking about Ryder Cups and down the road. And this is a guy we're going to be hearing from for quite a while, don't you think?
Bobby, okay, here's what I'm going to say. And this whole thing, and Sandy Tatum was the guy who once said it. And I'm paraphrasing. We're not trying to punish the best golfers in the world. We're trying to identify them, okay? I believe that happened. Jordan Spieth, if he hadn't screwed up the very end of his Friday round, do you think it's out of the realm of possibility off of what we've seen from him before that he couldn't have shot one of the 66s even if he had gotten it at 8 under par and made the cut on Friday? No. Look at the leaderboard we ended up with for a lot of yesterday. We had a guy, Patrick Reed, who I followed around on for quite a bit on Saturday, trying to win the second leg of the Grand Slam this year. Masters champion. We had Justin Rose until he fell back. U.S. Open champion. We had Dustin Johnson, U.S. Open champion. We had Tommy Fleetwood, who has been one of the best players in the world for the last 2 years. So this was, and we had Brooks Koepka, who played himself back into things on Saturday. And then to me, as someone who loves the course and loves to see how somebody stands in on the second nine of our national championship, that was a superb back nine. So the bogey he made on 11, he was in dead city, hit in the bunker. He's looking at five. He makes a putt. He saves par coming the next hole after that. He when he had to gouge it out of the fescue, he did. He never made the big number that other guys. And guys, let me ask you this about the course setup because it became such a dominant story, okay? Was it the course setup's problem that Tiger Woods made a 7 on one of the easier par 4s on the course on Thursday afternoon? Oh, by the way, from the middle of the fairway. Was it the course setup's problem that Ian Poulter made a 7 on number 8 from the middle of the fairway on Friday? Did the course do it to Jordan Spieth when he made a triple on number 11? Did the course do it to Dustin Johnson when he hit a shot on a par 3 to make his double on Saturday afternoon 40 yards to the right of the flagstick? That what I'm saying is they can blame the USGA and the course all they want. Most of the wounds inflicted on some of the most famous golfers in the world were self-inflicted on the weekend.
And it shows you, you're correct, and it shows you the fine-tuned, you know, piano string like temperament of a lot of these golfers, that if they don't get the round going the way that they want or whatever, they're not fighters, they're not strugglers, they just fall off, and then they, you know, the course screwed up or whatever. And the US Open isn't that kind of thing. You know, it's not a rhythm golf tournament where, you know, you just get into this stroke of, you know, yeah, I'm birdieing every other hole and I'm finishing every day 8 under 9 under 4 7 under. It's survival. That's what the U.S. Open is. You survive.
Yeah, and
it.
It's, and some great. Guys isn't are oriented great to towards watch
it. I love it. I love it. It looks, it's like football as golf. I think it's fine. I just don't get this. It strikes of almost an elitist entitlement kind of thing. You can't set up the golf course that we can predict exactly where our shots are going to land and exactly how they're going to fall with the right amount of spin and the right amount of wind and whatever. We're not playing.
That's just the thing, guys.
It's not going to happen.
They all intellectually, if we had them, grant you that the Open should be rigorous and the Open, and they can live with the idea of the par is good thing in the abstract. But when they get faced with the reality of it, then they want that. Yes. It's a shifting scenario. It's a shifting bar, you know, in their minds. I mean, I think they would all, I think if you interviewed them outside the context, oh yeah, the Open's different. We understand that. Everybody who goes there should understand that, blah, blah, blah. But then when they're faced with the reality of it, then, oh, it's a different story.
Bobby, but, When I love following Dan Jagan's missed his first Open in 61 years, but he still was fantastic on Twitter. And he used the same reference I wrote when I wrote my column on Saturday, which was this: when guys were shooting at the pin early yesterday, when the course was obviously a lot softer and the wind hadn't come up the way it would later on in the day, Dan said, okay, we've now resumed the John Deere Classic. And it's a great reference point. Mitch, to what you were speaking, they'll go to the Travelers Tournament this week, okay? And it'll have a good field, and somebody will shoot 18 under par and win. And somehow they have been conditioned to thinking that that's the way things are supposed to be. And, you know, Mitch, I love the outrage about the course, but we're supposed to think it's okay that guys can hit the ball 400 yards now. We're supposed to think it's okay to get these courses to defend themselves. We have to have like 530-yard par fours. They won't scale back the equipment. They won't scale back the golf balls. So you know what? Good on you, Shinnecock, for making them play this week.
Yep. And to the casual golf observer, this isn't good. You know, whining about courses isn't good. It doesn't strike interest. When they go over and play the British Open, which is next up in terms of the majors, nobody complains about the grouse or the high grass or whatever. Well, these are the courses. You know, that's what you do when you go over to the British Open, and you're going to land in stuff that's up to your knees, and you're going to have to find your way out of it, and the winds blow strong off of some of those locks and things like that. And everybody just accepts it. So I don't know why there's this, maybe because it's the U.S. Open and these are U.S. golfers and whatever, but it just strikes of a lot of whining, and I think I'm glad it's in the rearview mirror. And congratulations to Brooks Koepka, and let's see what he does with this.
And Mitch and Bob, Mike Davis was way more accountable about a couple of bad pins on Saturday than Phil Mickelson was for hitting a moving ball in what he knew was a violation of the rules. And again, you know, I'm not one of those guys who says, oh, what are we going to tell the kids about what Phil says? Keith Olbermann actually had a funny line. He said, in golf, kids are anybody under 50. To me, as someone who, again, loves the sport and loves the course, I loved the way the guys could get after it early yesterday. I loved the way Brooks Koepka stood in there, not only against the course and trying to become the first guy since Curtis to win back-to-back, but he's playing against his best friend. It felt like match play golf. And Bob, was it not great to watch this young man who did win at 16 under par, when the course was completely different at Erin Hills last year, make such fabulous saves under the pressure of our national championship coming home?
Absolutely. And I mean, this is why this guy is exemplary, and the idea of it all. And if someone had created this script that he would win one year at 16 under and wide open fairways, and he'd win the next year and more, shall we say, traditional U.S. Open golf scenario. No, I mean, I'm just thinking about now, you know, he's been outside this discussion. We've talked for the last, for good reason, in the last couple of years. What's it all been about? Going back to with Jason Day and Spieth and Thomas, the new young Turks, and not Brooks Koepka. And suddenly it's like, oh boy, Brooks Koepka is as good as anybody.
When you get on a list, Mitch, when you get on a list of back-to-back winners that includes Bobby Jones and Ben Hogan, forget about Curtis, who is a really wonderful player and one of the great citizens of the sport. You did something. You did something great, and he was great when he had to be. And you know what? It Mitch, you said something earlier. It felt like a real sports event yesterday.
Yeah.
It did. And I, you know, I'll defend golf and, you know, and them being athletes, but that was sports yesterday. And it was a great drama, and it was great to watch. And did you not think, just as a sports fan, forget about golf, that was compelling theater?
Yeah, and that's why I don't understand all the complaints. And Koepka, from what I, you know, have read and heard, is a real athlete too. You know, he played basketball and football and baseball. He wasn't just, you know, a golf nerd. And you know, that's a prototype for some of the new guys who are coming along. I think it's a good story all the way around. And I, you know, hopefully the whining goes in the past. And as you say, Phil Mickelson will be allowed back in church next Sunday, you know, with a couple of mea culpas and on we go. I if it's all right, I think we should shift to the new season of the NBA, which is, of course, off-season moves, off-season trades, NBA drafts, which is coming up this week. And interestingly, in the last 3 or 4 days, and I don't know why sometimes these things just jump to the forefront. I don't know if it's people whispering to one another. But we went from where's LeBron going to go being the number one, two, three, and four question to where's Kawhi Leonard going to go? Or to meld the two, could Kawhi Leonard and LeBron James end up on the same team in Los Angeles? And suddenly Kawhi Leonard, who we have not seen on a basketball court in a very long time, right? I mean, he has not played in a long time. I don't even know how healthy he is, but he is now the flashpoint of discussion in this offseason. What do you guys think about Mitch, where he's going to end up and what this is going to do to the balance of power?
I later on I will have what I hope my friends think is an amusing take on how I feel I speak for the group when I say all we want is for Kawhi to be happy. You know, it's the last thing I think about before I go to bed. But when you look at this, okay, do you not feel, Bob and Mitch, there's something we don't know about what happened to spoil things in San Antonio between this young man and the organization? And I'm not absolving him of anything that we've seen and heard from him, but what classier or well-run operation do we have in the history of basketball than the San Antonio Spurs? And apparently this guy can't wait to get his ass out of town.
No, it's very bizarre, and that's the great X factor, missing link in this thing. The idea that he would be so upset as to want to get out away from the most enlightened coach in the league, probably with Steve Kerr, but probably the most enlightened coach in the league, and an organization that has established itself as the premier well-run organization. Now, he's always been a quiet guy. We know that. Quiet's one thing.
Right.
But I wouldn't go so far as to say weird. Here's the thing that I'm thinking about in this regard. The only possible one that makes any sense to me, guys, and we have to now go back to the late 70s and a situation in Portland, Oregon, when Bill Walton questioned the medical care he was getting. I'm wondering, the only thing that comes into my mind? Is he upset with, did he think he was misdiagnosed, or is there some medical issue that has been the trigger for all this? Because I can't think of anything else.
Mitch, you think there's like in the Hitchcock movies, there's a MacGuffin here that we don't know about at this point.
I'm going to read you something that Greg Popovich said in 2012. Now, we all know Greg Popovich is a coach. He does not lavish praise easily. He's one of those understated guys and doesn't like to throw out a lot of compliments. This is after Kawhi Leonard had been there basically 1 year. Quote, I think he's going to be a star, and as time goes on, he'll be the face of the Spurs. At both ends of the court, he's a really special player, and what makes me so confident about him is that he wants it so badly. He wants to be a good player. I mean a great player. He comes early. He stays late. He's coachable. He's just like a sponge. When you consider he's only had 2 years of college and no training camp yet, you can see that he's going to be something else. That's Greg Popovich on Kawhi Leonard. I don't know what fell apart between him and the player, because let's face it, Popovich is the organization. He is the organization. I don't think Kawhi Leonard's mad at the owner. Something went on between Popovich. You saw the way Popovich was talking about Leonard very cryptically during the course of the year and at the end of the year and whether he'll ever be back and all the rest of it. It's folly for us to say too much about other than we're just speculating. But yes, Mike, my sense is, and Bob, that something in the way, I don't know if it's the way he was treated, Bob. I don't know if it's like the quality of medical care, but perhaps the way he was perceived as dogging it or not coming back
or
when
thought
he could
they were
have.
Rushing him back, Mitch.
Yeah, not
maybe
coming
that
back when
too,
he could
right?
have. You should have been back here. That engenders, you know, nothing really rankles an athlete, a highly tuned athlete, more than the sense that people don't think he's trying hard enough or he's interested in playing with pain. That's an ego thing. And that's the only thing I can think of that would lead him to this? He's not, his free agency is actually 19, right, in terms of his contract.
No,
right?
They have to trade him. Later. Yeah, they'd have to trade
him. So this is all about a forcing a trade, which they don't have to do at all, and yet people are talking about it as if this is some kind of done deal. Very, very strange, Bob.
All right, let me ask you this, Bobby, because there's this notion that we've talked around and about the Lakers and LeBron so often, okay? So let's say LeBron and Kawhi Leonard end up with the LA Lakers, okay? There's this notion that you can't challenge the Warriors or the Rockets right now. Let me give you some of the guys they have on their team right now. Lonzo, who I don't know how that would
he
work out.
He won't be there anyhow.
Kyle Kuzma, Brandon Ingram, Julius Randle, Luol Deng. There's some talent in place on this team. Now, you add two full, and again, people got to remember about Kawhi. Mitch and Bob, you know this. It wasn't so long ago that he was being discussed as an MVP candidate in the time of LeBron and Steph and James Harden and all the rest of them. I think you become an instant contender if you could add LeBron and a guy like Kawhi or Paul George.
I've said from the very beginning, he's not going anywhere alone, Mike and Mitch.
Right, right.
He's not going without one of those guys. He's going wherever he's not just going to the Lakers and plugging in with the kids. And I totally agree with you. I've been all over their young talent before they even got Kuzma. I'm not even worrying about Lonzo because of Randle and Ingram since last year. And but I don't think he's going anywhere, whether it's L.A. or whether it's Philadelphia. He's not going anywhere alone. He's getting a buddy. He's getting an ally. And I don't think how anybody can doubt that.
There's an except here, Bob. He doesn't control any of this. This is not LeBron James. He has to get San Antonio to trade him. Now, do you honestly think, knowing Popovich the way we do, that he's going to send Kawhi Leonard to the Lakers as part of the new power trio with because if he sends him, the Lakers can do whatever they want. Then the other guys that they're after, LeBron and George, are free agents. But they can't control getting Kawhi Leonard. That has to be a Greg Popovich blessed event. Why on earth would he build a new wall around himself for the next 2 to 3 years that he's not going to be able to scale with his team the way he's not going to be able to scale the Golden State Warriors? Why would he do that? If I'm Greg Popovich, I would send Kawhi Leonard anywhere but the Los Angeles Lakers. And can I ask another question? Is he not under contract? Is Kawhi Leonard going to say, I'm not going to play for you unless you trade me? What's he going to do, sit out the year? I mean, why are we acting as if this is it? Well, just because Kawhi Leonard wants it, he's going to get it, and he's going to get to go where he wants. Greg Popovich is the boss in this situation, and this is the last thing I see him doing.
Again,
am I crazy to say that?
No, you're not. And but it's so funny when these things in the past, Bob knows this, they have a way of working themselves out to the benefit of the star player. But now we've got a star coach, and again, we don't know what Pop, forget about 2012 now, Mitch, because that was a very interesting quote. We don't know what Pop thinks of this guy now. And when I read you the names of the young, talented players that are under contract in LA, is it inconceivable that he's done with Kawhi and he says, okay, give me two of those guys? Okay, I don't know whether it's Brandon Ingram or Julius Randle, or maybe he's seen something in Lonzo Ball and isn't afraid to take on the old man. Is it logical that he wants to help the Lakers? No, of course not. He's Pop. He's built one of the great operations in the history of the sport over the last two decades. But something, again, it sounds like I'm stuck on this. Something has made this relationship unsustainable. And until we know what that is, and whether it's Kawhi's side that's driving this or Pop's side, I don't even know how we can figure out what might be the next thing that could happen with this situation.
And if there is to be a trade with anyone, the other GM has to be completely assured that whatever the problem is, that it's not going to involve, it's fixed.
And his health, Bobby.
That's what he's talking about.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, I speak from a vantage point of the one city that everyone agrees has the wherewithal to make a trade that Popovich
Boston, Massachusetts.
Enjoy.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And if I'm Danny Ainge, before I do it, I need to know chapter and verse. What the hell's going on with this guy?
Would you trade Jaylen Brown for Kawhi Leonard?
Brown, yes. Tatum, no.
Oh, no. Tatum's on. We agree that Tatum's untouchable, right?
Just to make sure. Brown and something. Yes, and I like him, but Tatum is untouchable to me. No.
To me, I read this the piece that I think was on ESPN that kind of laid out how Boston could trade for Kawhi Leonard. And the overall thrust of the piece was what makes this so easy and possible is that they don't have anybody on – the Celtics have nobody scheduled to make between $6.7 million and $20 million in 2018-19. They don't have any $30 million contracts or anything like that. And, of course, the $20 million is Kyrie Irving. Most of their guys are younger and are making less. And to me, I read that and I say, that's exactly what you want. Why would you handcuff yourself to putting a Kawhi Leonard who's going to be a free agent after a year and is going to want $30 million a year? Why would you become that organization when you've worked so hard to be successful being an organization where you don't have to pay one guy $30 million. So I don't understand. I know the Celtics tried to make a trade for him at the trade deadline that they tried, Bobby?
Yeah.
But again, they were kind of a different team then. They hadn't accomplished what they have now accomplished in the playoffs, getting within one game of the finals. I think Danny Ainge looks at this team and says, are you nuts? Why would I break this up? I got two superstars coming back. Now, if I bring them back, I got the problem of how do I blend Kawhi Leonard in with Hayward and with Kyrie Irving? That's not as simple as it sounds. It's not. Remember, these things don't always work. Witness Oklahoma City. They don't always work where you put three superstars on a roster and it works. But Boston's got such a good thing going. Yeah. I don't know why they would try to wake
Bob
that up.
Let me ask you this. You fell in love with the Celtics team. Okay.
Yes.
They were one half away from going to the NBA finals without Kyrie and without Gordon Hayward. So I'm going to ask you this. Do Hayward and Irving, when they come back, fit what we saw in this run to the finals that they made and nearly made it to the finals?
Well, Irving certainly, because of the ability to get his own shot, they struggled on offense in that final half.
I'm more interested in Hayward, Bob. Does Hayward fit this group?
I can't even remember what his game was like, Mike, at this point. No, I'm very serious.
Well, he didn't play that much of it.
I'm very serious. How much of him did I really see in Utah? I'm not going to lie and BS people and pretend that I am an expert on Gordon Hayward as a pro. No, I'm not. I know his stature. I know the numbers, but I don't care about the numbers. His game, I don't have a firm. I was anxious to learn about his game, Mike. I can't pontificate about his game because I don't know his game. I'm being honest here.
No, that's why I'm saying, to quote the great William Goldman in Princess Bride, it's not inconceivable that they would consider moving Hayward even though he's only played 5 minutes for him, right, Mitch?
Well, look, Kawhi Leonard is a prize if he's healthy. We all know this. He's one of the great players in the NBA. And this is no small thing, he plays defense. And when it comes to championships, this isn't somebody who you're going to have to teach how to play defense like so many other star players in the league or young star players coming up. So I can see, for example, that LeBron James would put Kawhi Leonard in the category that he's now invented. You know, LeBron has now invented a new category of basketball player. It's the thinking basketball player. It's no longer the shooting, dunking, blocking or whatever. There's this new level of basketball player that he has identified, of which he is one of them. And there's a handful of other guys that he says, I want to be with guys who see the game before it happens, who think the game before it happens. Okay. I don't know how many besides himself fit in that, but he does think of, I would imagine, Kawhi Leonard in that category. Paul George, likely in that category. So that's a triple play. If they could all end up in L.A., and you've heard me say that I do think that LeBron James is going to end up in Los Angeles. He's already got a home there. There's rumors that he had already enrolled one of his kids in school there. I don't know if that's true or not. But it makes sense from a career point of view, and he can manipulate the roster with all that money that the Lakers have to get other star players. But one of those star players is Kawhi Leonard. It's a slam dunk, let alone whoever the third one is. But Mike, you said, oh, they've got all this young talent. Bob, you said they've got all this young talent. Let's face it. First of all, Luol Deng has to leave the team in order for anybody to come there. So he's out because of his contract. They're going to lose Lonzo Ball, and they're going to lose Julius Randle most likely, and probably one other guy in any kind of a trade situation, or they're going to have to clear roster space or salary space. So all that young talent that they have, a good chunk of it's going to go away if they add guys like those three that we're talking about. And while you would say, well, if you've got LeBron James, Kawhi Leonard, and Paul George, you can add Mike Lupica, Bob Ryan, and Mitch Albom, and you'll still do okay. But we have seen that you can be top-heavy with superstars and trip up. You do need a bench in this league. You do need the complementary players. You know, everyone thought LeBron James and Love and Kyrie Irving couldn't be beat, and the same thing with Oklahoma City, and we see what's happening.
All right.
So I don't know.
This is interesting. Okay, well, while we've been talking, I've just looked up a couple of things, and I started to weigh. The Hayward thing fascinates me because it is, Bob is absolutely right. You know, I mostly saw Gordon Hayward play in college. I didn't see a lot of him. I saw a lot when the Jazz beat the LA Clippers and upset them because they have one of the best coaches that nobody talks about in the league, which is Quinn Snyder. Gordon Hayward is a year older than Kawhi Leonard. Start there. You know, we still think of Hayward as the kid from Butler. And both of them are coming off big injuries. So Kawhi Leonard is a better basketball player than Gordon Hayward. The question is, if you're Danny, you don't think to yourself, oh, I'm upsetting the great chemistry we had with Gordon. You didn't have Gordon. You had him for 5 minutes. And then we never saw how Gordon and Kyrie were going to play together. And then you have to factor in, if you're talking about Kawhi to the Celtics, Bob, Kyrie becomes a free agent after next year, right?
Option thing, yeah.
He
was non-committal last week about long-term. He can't, certainly not to sign anything now simply because it would be ridiculously foolish for him to forfeit the kind of money he can get rather than just getting an extension.
But Mitch and Bob, what I'm saying is we can't talk about how somebody coming in from the outside like Leonard would upset team chemistry because we don't know what the team chemistry is with Hayward.
Right.
Kyrie, and all the guys who made the run.
Plus, I really believe that we do have a firm fix on the nature of Leonard's game, and I have not the slightest worry about Leonard fitting into anything. He's a completely well-rounded, intelligent, adaptable player. He would fit, and this group, I think he'd be marvelous with this group, quite frankly. Mm.
Well, it's fascinating that we have talked this far in the NBA and not really talked about LeBron James and, you know, six other cities where he might be going. So I like this. At least we're talking about somebody else, whether it's folly or craziness or
whatever.
Thank
you, Kawhi. Thank you, Kawhi.
And now the NBA draft is in front of us here now, too. And you know, I'm fascinated by this only in that there are players here. Like, I happen to be looking while we're talking here at Sports Illustrated's projection, and I guess they've been doing this forever and a day, and this is their final draft board, the final draft board, you know, draft 1.0, 2.0, 6.0, 9.0. Here's the final one okay, this is exactly how it's going to go. These are the best players. And they put DeAndre Ayton as the best player possible to pick, the center out of Arizona. He's 7 foot. He played 1 year, could not get his team past what was the first round. Who did they lose to? Was it Buffalo or somebody that they, you know, couldn't get him past one game in the NCAA tournament, but he's going to make your team the most successful. They've got Luka Doncic from Real Madrid as number two, and Jaren Jackson Jr. as the third best player coming out of the draft. Now, the reason that this makes me curious is that Jaren Jackson Jr. played like about an hour from me at Michigan State. We barely talked about this guy. Michigan State had a subpar year. They crapped out in the tournament. He was one of a couple, and he's better than Marvin Bagley III now. This is what, I don't know, drives me both bonkers and yet leaves me kind of, you know, in the dark. They analyze these guys who have so little actual success at the college level, and they project them to be difference makers in the NBA. Bob, you've been watching more basketball than all of us. Is there a new approach to the draft that they just start valuing other things? Is it all just bionics?
Well, there's, you know, the whole workout thing and things that people have boosted themselves or hurt themselves, but very often boosted themselves with workouts, going as far back as the Kobe Bryant, whose workouts dazzled people. There's that. There's also two categories of players that are very two attributes of modern big men that are very highly sought after. And one, of course, is stretch the floor, which Ayton can do. The other is protect the rim, which Jackson can do. And the other guy that intrigues me among the people, I find some intriguing players in the mix. And Bamba at Texas is a floor as a rim protector type. Mm-hmm. Williams Robert Williams is another one. And yes, to answer your question, I just think that there's certain attributes that are prized at any given point in time, and those are two.
Well, when you look at Ayton, when we look at Ayton, okay, and there's really only one transformative, classic, down by the basket player in the league right now, and that's Anthony Davis. Okay, he is a transformative. He is an old fashioned guy with new age skills. This incredible skill set. Bobby, do you think that a center will ever again be transformative enough to be the best player on a team that can win the NBA championship?
Well, we've got two guys.
Bob,
in the
what
mix.
I'm asking you is this:
all right,
do you ever think?
Let me ask you a question. What do you call Anthony Davis? He's a big. The thing is,
he's
we're
a
now
big.
In the world of
I'm asking you, Kevin Durant's a big, but he's a modern big, which means
We're in the world of, firmly in the world of generic bigs. Generic bigs as opposed to fours and fives are the thing. The old-fashioned, the Al Davis, the Al McGuire aircraft carrier center is alleged to be passé completely. If that's what you're alluding to, that old-fashioned center kind of thing, they're not in vogue right now. Could someone come along to alter the equation? Theoretically, but the three-point is such a king thing now, and it wonder. But we do have two guys I'm going to throw at you who are mixtures. They are hybrids. They are a mix of the old and a mix of the new, for sure. Joel Embiid and Karl Anthony Towns. They can each post your ass up as right. well as face up and hit the three. What is Anthony Davis? But, he can do the same
but Bob,
thing.
Here's what I'm asking about Ayton. We will agree that he's better close to the basket right now at this stage in his career than he is far away from the basket. Fair assessment of his game?
Yes.
Okay. Will the game ever again be played inside out? That I guess that's a long way around to ask you. Will the game is in the three-point world, could the game ever be played inside out ever again?
Well, I watched Embiid in a playoff game against the Celtics go for 31, the majority of which were post-ups, which was, I found, exhilarating, refreshing, and thrilling. I don't say never, it's dangerous. It's that's the trend. But that's the trend. All I can say, I just wonder when are people going to. I'm not going to get on the 3-point soapbox. I want to stick to the issue. I'll stick to the issue. It's a great question, Mike. It's a great question. And the fact is that if Ayton is number one, it's because he is Embiidish or townish.
Embiidish.
Let me read you off of my list that informs me so well here from Sports Illustrated. We thank them for this. So listen to this here, the number one projection. So Ayton is 7 foot and identified as a center. Number two is Doncic, who was the only guard in the top five or six, and he's 6'8", and he's a guard from over in Europe. Jaren Jackson is 6'11", a center identified. Marvin Bagley III, 6'11", identified as a forward center. Bamba out of Texas, 7 foot. Identified as a center. Wendell Carter Jr. out of Duke, 6'10", identified as a center. Everybody is, Michael Porter Jr., 6'10". There are no little point guards here in these top seven positions. And Mike, you're right when you identified, Kevin Durant is 7 foot the way that, I'm 5'8". He just moves at 7 foot. There's no tallness to him. He's just incredibly tall, but he plays like a guard. LeBron James the same way. And so your height no longer identifies you as the center, But all of these guys need to be at least that height because, as you said, Bob, stretch the game, protect the rim, wingspan, all the rest of this stuff. Who was the last, in your mind, the last inside out, as Mike said, guy? Was it Shaq? I mean, to really play, you know, at a, we're a team.
Yeah, Shaq
really,
and Hakeem Olajuwon when he won two for Houston.
Olajuwon was before
so
Shaq.
So now the answer is Shaq, Mitch. The answer is Shaq.
Shaq was the last guy who you bounced it in, you let him bounce back into the board, put it up, baby hook or whatever it was. That was it.
The last
that was
one
him.
Of consequence.
And that's a while ago.
Of consequence, because there have been others, but no question. That's how far, and we have to go back a ways. Yeah, he's already in the Hall of Fame. He's been out long enough.
And, you know,
it's a different
Mitch,
game.
One of the reasons when you talk about how there's such a small sampling of college basketball, as you know, in this modern world for them to evaluate, that's why a guy like Mikal Bridges is becoming more and more of a fascinating prospect. And there's a lot of talk about him in New York City because he comes as a fully formed college basketball player. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's true, and the all these intangibles that we always talk about in the NBA that a work ethic, a absolute have to have it kind of win thing, you cannot measure them, and this is what's so crippling to me about the current NBA system in college ball. You can't measure them looking at a kid's career when the kid's college career, and forget high school, everybody's a star in high school. Everybody dominates in high school. If you weren't a freak in high school, you're not even going to get to this level. But if all you have in college is A, that first part of the season where you play our sisters of the weak and hopeless, you know, and the exhibition teams that come in that help pad your record. B, your conference schedule, which depending on the conference that you're in, may or may not be good. So, you know, if you're coming out of the ACC, you have a handful of Duke North Carolina games. If you're in the Big Ten, you got a couple of Michigan State, Ohio State, Wisconsin games, and then the tournament. In which case, a lot of these teams get knocked out weirdly in the first round, like Arizona. What on earth can you judge in terms of a kid's desire to win, leadership qualities, anything like that? That was your whole body of work to judge by, which is why it just becomes a how high can you jump, how much can you bench press, let's watch you spin and dunk in front of us here. But there's no measurement of the personality that it takes to win. And that's why I think teams are getting so surprised with their draft picks, and some of them crap out and some of them turn out to be these great finds. Yeah, like we're looking at the Celtics guys, and nobody thought that those kids were going to be that good coming out of college. But, you know, maybe that's what Danny Ainge does homework differently than other people and finds out their personality.
Well, let's give full credit, since you're on that tack, Mitch, to the Utah Jazz for identifying Donovan Mitchell, who will be the rookie of the year, more than likely, or either here or Simmons. But, you know, look where he was taken, and look how good he is. And this particular draft, we've got like a couple of Exhibit A's in what you're talking about. Michael Porter Jr.
Yeah.
Who barely played. I mean, compared to this, Kyrie Irving was like going for the gold watch. He played 11 games. This guy played 3, I think.
All right. Here's two guys I love in this draft. And I want to know what you guys think of both of them because they did both get a lot of airtime in college basketball this year. I love Bagley. I love Bagley's skill set. I love his game. I love his attitude. I love him. But Mike, the biggest question I have about the first round of this draft is the following. How good is Trae Young? Is Trae Young going to turn out to be Steph on training wheels, or is he going to turn out to be, I don't know, Brandon Jennings?
If we knew that, we'd be working for the NBA.
Yes, but that's why I'm asking my friends this question. How good do you think Trae Young is?
Well, he's 6'1", first of all. And, you know,
that's why I said Brandon Jennings, Mitch.
Yeah, but he's 6'1". You know, he played at Oklahoma. He can shoot deep like Steph. I mean, way, way deep. You know, he's one of those guys who'll throw it up from off a screen from way, way out there. But 6'1" small. I think he has to be in one of those places where you got to be in the right. You got to be in the right system. I don't think he's a star anywhere he goes.
Bobby, what do you think of Trae Young?
I went on record relatively, late in the year that to support the thesis you just heard that I think he's going to certainly be in the league, but I would. I don't see for stardom. I just don't. I would be very hesitant to go take him.
And do we not need Mo Bamba to be a star in the NBA just on his name alone?
Mo Bamba.
Oh, it's.
I don't think you have to worry about that. I think.
I don't think we have to. I think he is going to be a star, Bob. Don't you think he's? I mean, he is the whole package.
He's a very intriguing.
There's been a lot of buzz about him.
Very intriguing growth stock. I think Bamba, and I think he goes no lower than 5.
Well, we'll
it's
see.
It's a deep and compelling. I'll tell you something, Mitch, for all the big guys you mentioned and all the question marks that there are, because there are always question marks, okay? This to me is a deep and interesting. Am I wrong? This is a deep and interesting and compelling draft.
It's a deep, interesting talent-laden draft in terms of potential talent in the league. But what's going to make it, what always makes a draft interesting, is who the teams are, where they're picking, and how transformative could one player be to that team. Now, when I look at the draft order, I mean, Phoenix is a long way from, one guy's not going to take them into the playoffs next year. Sacramento, right. The same thing. They're number 2. Atlanta's pretty crappy. Memphis, Dallas is number 5. Orlando is 6. Chicago is 7. And Cleveland is 8. Mm. And, Cleveland, to me, even though they're at 8, they're the most intriguing one because of what happens or doesn't happen with LeBron James. With all these guys that we just listed, with Bamba, with Ayton, with Trae Young, with all this, is there a significant player still at 8 that could make a difference?
Mitch, before we get to parting shots, and I referenced this the other day when I was talking to Jordan on the Friday podcast, to me, everything we're talking about and what a crapshoot it is ultimately like in every single NBA draft, okay? Go back to Steph's draft in 2009. Steph Curry was the 7th pick in the NBA draft that year, okay? Here are 4 of the people who James Harden was taken ahead of him, Blake Griffin was taken ahead of him, okay? Here are the other 4 people who were taken ahead of Steph Curry. Hasheem Thabeet, Tyreke Evans, Ricky Rubio, and the immortal Johnny Flynn. Johnny Flynn from Syracuse was taken by the T-Wolves with the pick before Stephen Curry. You want to know how much of a crapshoot this is? That's how much of a crapshoot this is.
Yep, and I promise you 10 years from now, we'll be saying the exact thing about this draft. All right, it is time for our parting shots. And Bob Ryan, why don't you lead off?
They are rejoicing in Mexico City, Reykjavik, and Geneva. They are jumping off buildings and bridges in Berlin, Buenos Aires, and Rio. Ronaldo is up. Messi is down. Morocco lost to Iran on an own goal. We've had phenomenal drama already, and the 2018 World Cup is only 5 days old. Sadly, the USA is not a part of it, but if you are a student of history, politics, and yes, sport, you can't help but getting yourself hooked and intrigued. I am. Storylines abound. How far can a country of 330,000 people go? Will the country that invented this sport break through for the first time in 62 years? Is Mexico a serious contender? Was that just a hiccup, or is Germany vulnerable? Will a coach get sacked in the middle of the tournament? Hey, you never know. Most importantly, will the Icelandic TV guy lose his mind if they actually win a game? God love the World Cup. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
You know, I wasn't lying before, Mitch and Bob. I just want Kawhi Leonard to be happy. And I'm like you guys, I can't remember the last time I actually saw him play a game of basketball for, as I said before, one of the classiest and most successful organizations in the history of the NBA. Now we've read all of these headlines and we have speculated ourselves about whether he might end up with the Lakers. And by the way, I think that reading that headline about any NBA star either about to become a free agent or wanting to be traded, saying he wants to be a Laker, ought to now be a drinking game. If everybody I've heard might be on their way to L.A. in the recent past actually ended up in L.A., the Lakers would have already won 16 more titles, and that's just in the last 5 years. But here's the thing about Kawhi. He's exactly like a lot of other young basketball stars who have become rich and famous in the AAU culture of the modern NBA. He doesn't want to just be happy himself. He thinks there was a law passed that he ought to be able to play wherever he wants.
I have a dream. It's not a big one. My dream is to get to see Iceland, have a nice vacation there. Here's the problem. I've waited all these years figuring, what's the hurry? Nobody wants to go to Iceland. And now I'm in danger of finally getting there and running into more traffic than the Long Island Expressway. That's because Iceland is soaring in popularity. Suddenly, it's become the darling for Airbnbs. It's popping up on cable shows and internet sites. And now, adding insult to injury, it's in the World Cup for the first time, only the most popular sporting event in the world. Well, I figured, okay, they'll crap out early, keeping them off the radar. But no. Very first game against Argentina of all sides. Argentina with a World Cup history as rich as the Yankees in baseball. And what happens? Iceland plays them to a draw, including stopping the great Lionel Messi on a penalty kick when Iceland goalie Hannes Halldórsson made the stop of his life. Great. Keep it up, Hannes. By the time the World Cup is over, you won't be able to get a hotel room in Iceland without a 2-year wait. That's going to wrap up the Sports Reporters Podcast for this Monday. We thank you for joining us, folks. We do this every Monday and Friday. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can leave us a comment. If you didn't, you can leave us a comment. We'll enjoy them either way. Tell your friends that you can get this podcast anywhere you get popular podcasts. And we will see you again on Friday. Until then, on behalf of Bob Ryan and Mike Lupica, this is Mitch Albom saying, have a great week.